Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. North Texans are still absorbing the jarring news that an act of terrorism took place in Garland Sunday. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack by two roommates from Phoenix, allegedly. Elton Simpson and Nadir Sufi drove to North Texas with a car full of body armor, military assault rifles, and apparently plans to storm a competition sponsored by the American Freedom Defense Initiative, a group that has been described as an active anti-Muslim organization by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The competition invited artists to draw cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad, who, according to Muslim tradition, should never be depicted, with the promise of a cash prize for the winning image. An unarmed security guard posted at the entrance to the facility was wounded before the two alleged gunmen were shot dead by police on the scene. Now, local and federal authorities are trying to determine how and why the attack was planned and whether the gunmen were indeed working directly for ISIS or simply inspired by its bloody tactics. Journalist Stella Chavez has been covering this story for KERA News. Stella, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's good to be here.
So there were 200 people at the Curtis Colwell Center in Garland, which I gather is owned by Garland ISD, but was not a school-related event.
Correct. They have events there throughout the year, and yeah.
So 200 people on Sunday night. Most were not harmed, except for the security guard. What do we know about the latest in the investigation at this point?
Well, we don't have a lot of new information. It's my understanding that both the FBI and Garland Police Department are both investigating, although it's unclear who's really taking the lead. The first day, Garland Police Department was very good about updating reporters, but since then, they've not released any additional information. We know that the FBI had an open investigation or case on one of the gunmen, Elton Simpson. We know that, we've heard from family members of Nadir Sufi, who was actually born in Dallas and a Texas Health Presbyterian, but the family moved away after some time. So really all we know is what's been reported so far.
You spent time in one of the neighborhoods that was close to the crime scene. What was the mood there? What are residents saying about what happened? How are they feeling right now?
Right. It was interesting to spend some time Monday afternoon. I drove around several areas close by, and there is this one neighborhood. It's very small homes, about $200,000, $300,000 homes. And the neighbors there are apparently very close. They're unlike other neighborhoods, unlike perhaps my neighborhood. Everyone knows each other on a first-name basis. They even have each other's cell phone numbers. So they are good about texting each other whenever there's a concern about something or question about something. So I was told that evening, people began seeing a lot of commotion, officers in the area. Some of the areas were blocked off. One neighbor said he had just passed by the center, the Curtis Colwell Center, about 10 minutes before this shooting happened. And he went home and then walked out down the street. And an officer said, you need to go back home. And so, they soon learned that there had been the shooting. And they said they were really worried. One neighbor, which you'll hear from in a minute, Sarah Rojas and Jim Gallegos, they talk about what it was like for them on their street.
It was really scary and concerning. I also have an 8-year-old, and she was crying, she was scared. It's hard, it's really hard.
If anything, it's probably going to have us all talk more about watching out more. We've got a neighborhood watch, so we have a neighborhood watch coordinator who advises us all. I think we need to step it up a little bit more now. In light of this, we need to be very watchful of what is going on.
Yeah, as you hear Jim talking there, Jim Gallegos, I think the feeling is that it's sort of a wake-up call to this neighborhood and to residents in Garland that something like this can happen anywhere, that no one is really safe. Obviously, they feel safe in their neighborhood, but they realize at any moment something could blow up, something could happen, and they have to be willing to work together and alert each other. And was alarming and unsettling for them, but they feel like, we are a good group of neighbors, and so we can get past this, and our kids will, one of the daughter of a woman said, she was very scared, but it's a good, learning experience for them at least.
Lots of people would like to thank and congratulate the police officer who was able to take down the gunman. Do we know why this officer has asked not to be identified?
No, I spoke to his attorney yesterday, and, you know, as you may have heard, he's being hailed as a hero in the community. And but at this time, you know, his attorney says he would like to just maintain his privacy, and he asks people to just respect that because he wants to spend time with his family. You know, the police would just say that, you know, he's a traffic officer, and, you know, he's, I think I've read he was a veteran police officer, so he's had experience. But we don't know how much and if he's ever been in a situation like this before.
It's a day that officers train very hard for, but it's always a surprise when it happens. And he was just experienced and skilled enough to recognize what was going on and act quickly enough to, you know, to save a lot of people. Hero is too often just a cliche that we throw around all the time, but and there's no other way to describe his bravery and his skill that he showed on Sunday evening.
And that's his attorney, Zach Horn. And I also want to mention the other officer who was there that evening. His name is Bruce Joyner. He has been identified, and he's a Garland School District security officer. So he was unarmed. And one thing I thought was interesting, I saw a report yesterday that people have come out, and not a very large group, but a few people were standing outside or near the Curtis Colwell Center, just sort of showing their support with banners and flags. And I noticed it seemed like a pretty diverse group. And I think one thing that we can take away from this is that, you know, regardless of what community you're in, whether it's the Muslim community, you know, we've heard or seen expressions of both, you know, concern, but also praise for this officer from many different people from different walks of life.
Stella, I know you have lots more reporting to do today. We won't keep you too much longer, but for an event that had 200 attendees, my understanding is there were dozens of police officers, security officers, there were SWAT teams there. Were those present expecting something bad to happen?
Well, we've been told that they there had been a lot of chatter prior to this event. I mean, people knew this was coming, and it had received a lot of attention in the press because of the nature of it. It was a controversial event, and I think police were told to sort of be on alert, which is why there were so many there. But it's unclear, at least to me, what exactly they knew. But you may have seen reports about messages that went out on social media, I believe a few minutes before or a few days before this happened. So given the nature of the event, who was involved, this was put on by the American Freedom Initiative, which is a New York-based organization, and Pamela Geller was the main person there, and she's a, you know, controversial figure. So police have said, you know, based on what's happened in the past or the attention these events have received, you know, we wanted to be careful and on guard.
We don't know yet if anyone else was involved with this. The two most obvious suspects have been killed. So in a case like that, how does the investigation move forward, knowing that there may not be prosecution at the end of this, but everyone wants to know exactly what happened and how this happened?
Right. Well, they are looking, investigators, and I believe mostly, you know, FBI, for this end of the investigation, are looking at any known associates of these two men. So there have been reports of a third person who was in contact with Elton Simpson, I believe, via social media, who had sent him messages. And I can't remember if it was Twitter or on some other platform. But so they definitely want to look at, you know, what are the conversations that these two men had with other associates. You know, they're talking to everybody who's known them. You know, they were roommates. They were known in their apartment complex to the neighbors. They're looking at all of that, where the ammunition or the assault rifles were purchased.
All right. Reporter Stella Chavez has been covering the attack in Garland for KERA News. Stella, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Later in the hour, we'll speak with the executive director of the North Texas chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Aliyah Salem. Now, though, we have Robert Taylor with us. He is director of the Executive Master of Science Program in Justice Administration and Leadership within the Department of Criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas, and co-author with Charles Swanson of the new book, Terrorism, Intelligence, and Homeland Security. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we have heard that ISIS is issuing statements claiming responsibility for this attack. Is there evidence that the group had direct or even indirect contact with Simpson and Sufi?
Well, I don't know if there's direct evidence. Clearly, both of the suspects in this case had had expressed ideologies that were parallel with what ISIS projects to the world. So, when you're talking about the Islamic State, you're talking about a large movement across the Middle East, and, millions of people share that sentiment.
ISIS has termed them soldiers of the caliphate. Does that term have any specific meaning, or could it also just mean friends of the operation?
Oh, no. No, it has a very, very specific meaning. In the Middle East, particularly in Islam and in radical Islam, the idea that we have a caliphate, which is basically the union of the state and religion together, is critically important. This is what the early beginning of Islam was all about with Muhammad. Through the centuries, it's basically progressed to individualized states. Now what you have is a very legitimate movement in the Middle East under the Islamic State, headed by a fairly intelligent guy, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who's been on the presence of the international stage for quite some time, leading his people to what he wants to be a unified state that's Islamic. I think most Americans think of Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL, whatever we're going to call it, in the United States today, as something akin to Al-Qaeda. It's not. It has nothing to do with being a group. It is a very large movement in the Middle East, and it's a substantial movement.
What we've heard in the past, the analysis of ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State in the past, is that they're not specifically interested in carrying out attacks on foreign soil. What they're interested in doing is building the movement within the regions that they control and the regions that border them.
That's correct.
So is this really an anomaly if indeed there is a relationship between the attack we saw on Sunday and ISIS?
Well, I don't think it would be an anomaly at all. I think if you read the reports that come out of Justice, State Department, and the like, what a lot of the progressive thinkers on terrorism are suggesting is that we have a lot of lone wolves or homegrown terrorists that are in the United States, that are oftentimes born in the United States, converted to Islam, now are radical Islamicists, and they're acting on their own. Now, they're not directed by a very singular mission by someone overseas, but they are indeed incited, how's that, or encouraged from social media sources or from individuals that preach a very strong, ardent, Salafi jihadist kind of ideology. And so these people take arms up. They grab very unsophisticated bombs like we saw in Boston during the Boston Marathon, and they take action.
Robert Taylor is director of the Executive Master of Science Program in Justice Administration and Leadership at UT Dallas and co-author of the new book, Terrorism, Intelligence, and Homeland Security. We'll resume our conversation with him in a few minutes. Later in the hour, we'll speak with Aliyah Salem of the Dallas-Fort Worth Council on American-Islamic Relations. If you'd like to join the portion of the conversation now with Robert Taylor, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org. Or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In light of Sunday's terrorist shooting in Garland, we are speaking this hour with Robert Taylor, who directs the Executive Master of Science Program in Justice Administration and Leadership within the Department of Criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas. His new book is called Terrorism, Intelligence, and Homeland Security. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Bob, given that terrorism certainly is frightening, it certainly gets a message across, but does very little to endear new people to the cause. People don't like terrorism. Why does anybody choose this as a vehicle to make a statement about anything?
Well, you have to understand the fundamental perspective that terrorists basically engender, which is, look, they're right now trying to make a statement that they are a real entity in the Islamic State. I mean, these are very powerful words that that their leader, Baghdadi, does. When he calls himself a caliph, when he talks about the United States as being the Satan, when he talks about issues about the establishment of Israel, those are really powerful words to people who have felt like they've been suppressed, people who have been bombed recently and during the Gulf Wars and the war in Iraq, people who have been, you know, moved out of their homeland. There's an internal struggle in Islam as well between Shiites and Sunnis. That's vaulted to the Middle East political stage as well. So terrorism, basically kind of embodies a way of life that we see in the Middle East on a very common basis. And people have been at war for now 10 years. So to say that it's something new to them is not true. They're very adept at learning new ways, new methodologies to bring attention to their causes.
So how is it that two young men raised in the relative safety and comfort and tolerance of the United States would latch on to messages like these?
Well, that's a great question. That's probably the thing that plagues us the most, is we don't know how to really solve this lone wolf problem. We don't know how to prevent these kinds of acts. You could trace some of these activities all the way back to the old Al-Qaeda manual that talked about striking at major athletic events or where there's big crowds of people. And, we don't know how to stop them. We do know that people that we've seen in Europe and the United States in often cases have been disenfranchised, unemployed, grabbed a hold of this ideology for personal belonging, and someone is preaching a very violent kind of ideology outside the United States in the Middle East, which it appears that these guys had contact with over the internet, and then they go out and conduct these acts of random violence. I mean, we in Texas have seen it before, down in Malik Hassan, and the bombing down at Fort, or the shooting down at Fort Hood, same kind of event.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Mario calling from Plano. Hi, Mario.
Hi, Chris. First of all, I love your show, and I'm glad you brought this important topic, to the air. First of all, before I start, I should say I am a veteran, did two tours in Iraq, so obviously pretty familiar with everything that's going on as far as terrorism. First of all, obviously the actions of the two individuals are not defendable. They were obviously trying to kill innocent people. But I think what people should talk about is the anti-Islamic, organization that put this event on. I just feel that there should be something said to them, because I feel that them knowing especially what happened in Paris with the Charlie Hebdo situation, I think they probably, should have been more prepared, because to me, 200 people is a lot of people to put at risk, especially with knowing what this could bring up because of past incidents. And That's all I have.
Thanks for your call. A lot probably to respond to there, Bob. But first of all, would you talk about, is it reasonable to compare this event calling for cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad with the work that was being done by Charlie Hebdo? Where do those comparisons start and end?
Well, first of all, let me thank the caller for his service to our great country here. Two tours in Iraq. My hat's off to you. But I think he raises the central topic of discussion in this incident. The United States is a very tolerant country, and we need to remind ourselves of being tolerant of other cultures and other religions. I mean, how would American audiences feel if there was a contest to depict Jesus in various forms as a cartoon? I mean, I think there would be a number of people would be very upset. Probably very, very conservative groups would demonstrate. And the alike. So it's very important for us to understand, to be tolerant of different cultures and different religions, and clearly this was an affront to them. And it's very similar to what Charlie Hebdo incident occurred last summer, or last couple months ago, I guess it was, when we end up seeing targeted attacks on individuals who have indeed, in the mind of radical Islam, defaced the prophet. So, you know, it's kind of like running up a red flag and saying, hey, here I am, I'm making fun of your religion, and then we're doing this because it's free speech. Well, yes, and I certainly honor our Second Amendment to free speech, but good gracious, folks, let's get our head tied on right and not be a front to other cultures and other religions that exist around the world. That's not the way America has been. I think that it was a very poor choice on the part of the American Freedom Defense Initiative to sponsor such a thing. I think they realized that there would be a high potential of violence, or at least the potential of an attack. I think that's why the city of Garland did the appropriate things that they do to try to prevent this and to lessen it as much as they possibly could.
Pamela Geller, who runs the American Freedom Defense Initiative, has said she does not hate Muslims, but her organization has been called anti-Muslim by human rights advocates at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Is it your sense, Bob, that the Muhammad cartoon contest was a deliberate provocation by the AFDI?
Well, that would be my personal opinion. I think it was. I'm always interested in people who belong to and head organizations and say, well, they really don't hate people. They just have a major problem with them. We heard that from the Ku Klux Klan, the Christian Identity groups for years. Well, we don't hate African Americans, but, you know, we still have a problem with, you know, them involved in our society and living free. So I get sick of organizations that try to hide behind the veil of, oh, we really don't have a personal grudge, or we don't have a personal kind of identity associated with our ideology. In my opinion, that's garbage. I think that they clearly understood that the cartoon would and the cartoon contest would be offensive to every Muslim that exists in this world.
When we talk about free speech, it's important to point out that there was no government attempt to censor the speech or the free expression of the American Freedom Defense Initiative. Is that getting lost here as we're arguing over whether they did or did not have a free speech right to express themselves this way?
Well, I don't think things are getting lost here. I think that, you know, the Second Amendment was developed precisely for what you said. The government cannot stand in and say what can and cannot be can be said. We need to be accountable for what we say. These groups need to be accountable for what they say. And I don't know how we're going to do that. I haven't thought all the way through that entire structure. But certainly we need to be tolerant of the beliefs of other people. I mean, ask yourself this, as a Christian country, as a Christian nation, we've oftentimes tried to talk about our country being that way. How would we feel if depictions of Christ were set up as a contest by organizations in the Middle East or in Texas? I'm sure there would be a tremendous amount of concern about that. So rather than waving red flags and hiding behind the idea, hey, we have the freedom to say whatever we want, what we should be doing is trying to be tolerant, trying to embrace the diversity that we have in our great culture, and trying to figure out how we can sit down and somehow make peace between these different cultures and religions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Andrew in Dallas. Hi, Andrew.
Good afternoon. first, we salute the good people of the police of Garland for saving lives. Second, if we didn't poke those two terrorists, if we didn't lure them to come to Garland, wouldn't they have gone and looked for a soft target and killed more people? Nobody provoked the officer in Texas who killed 13 of his colleagues. I'm not condoning and I'm not passing any judgment on the event or the cartoons, but I'm just thankful that those two terrorists were lured and killed before they kill people.
Thanks for your call. I don't know that we have, Bob, evidence that these two were planning anything else. We don't know all that much about their process in bringing this act about. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I hate to use the word lured. I understand what the, I think I understand what the caller was trying to express, which is I'm glad that we were able to stop them from conducting some kind of major terrorist event that would be much more violent and result in a lot more life. I don't think we lured anyone, but we certainly waved that red flag in front of the bull.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Alex is on the line now in Louisville. Hello, Alex.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Great show.
Thanks.
Really great topic, and I think two callers ago, Mario was really hitting it on the spot and really drawing our eye to look at it, where it's happening is where, you know, just because I have the right to yell fire doesn't mean I'm going to go doing it in a public place, you know, so we do show some tolerance. And we don't want government to be coming in and telling us what to do, but the government can help us create a capacity to have a conversation about how we can, you know, personally not invite people to come in and to do these sorts of things. And I wonder, the city of Garland, you know, what sort of, I know they saw that there might be a threat and put out the appropriate police force, but how about a conversation about whether it would be good for the community, whether it's a good thing, whether 200 people are worth the possible lives of many more, or children, being involved with an ISD type of facility. I mean, it just didn't seem like tolerance or real, there was a real discussion about whether this is a good decision or a skillful decision versus whether I can do it just because I can do it.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think he's right on. I really think it's an excellent point that he made. One of the things that I would caution him to remember is that even though we have a very distasteful group to the general audience of America or to the general audience in Texas, they do have a right to bring together this little committee. They have the right to express what they want and the like. I think that the city of Garland should be applauded for their actions. What they did was think through this. I do think they did. They required, I think, a substantial amount of money up front from this group so that they could hire extra police officers for security. I think they anticipated wisely that this could be a potential terrorist site and acted appropriately. Now, as distasteful as it is, you know, the groups that we hate in the general audience of America still have the right to demonstrate and to voice their opinion. And then democracy is tough stuff. You know, we have to kind of look at the middle road here. Both groups need to have the opportunity to discuss and to be able to say what they believe and express their feelings, but we don't need to have violence.
It's particularly chilling that it appears that Elton Simpson used social media to broadcast his intentions in the moments before the attack began. What do you know about how law enforcement agencies monitor that sort of communication and how they decide what to take seriously and what to sort of monitor but basically let go?
Well, I think they did a great job. I happen to be involved with one of the fusion centers in Dallas quite extensively, the Collin County Fusion Center, and I know they were on top of this from the very beginning, and I can't believe that the Dallas Police Department didn't have their fusion center up and running as well. So, I mean, I was looking at this as the event was going down, and I was aware personally of some of that email. So if I knew about the email and the social media, for sure the police did. So I think they were on top of it. I think they were trying desperately to try to prevent these kinds of things. And but again, you talk about the freedom of expression and the freedom of speech. People have the right to use social media in this kind of event.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Tariq on the line in Dallas now. Hi, Tariq.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wanted to say, first of all, like this event, as an American Muslim, it was very offensive, very insulting, and just not feel right. I mean, but the reaction to it, I feel, was more stupid. That's how exactly I felt when the Charlie Hebdo event happened. I know that the Muslim authorities in America, they actually advised not to do any protests to bring attention to this event, which was great. And I just really feel bad that that these two guys decided to come out and do this, which was completely wrong.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, freedom of expression and freedom of speech, that's totally fine, but it has to be in limits where you're not really disrespecting or offending other communities living in the same society. I mean, that just kind of alienates us and also make us just feel like less important.
Thanks so much for your call.
Right. Well, I couldn't agree more with what the caller was saying. You know, we have to remember there's a billion plus, 1.2 billion people in the world are Islamic. It's a great world religion, and it's a religion which does indeed preach peace and harmony and love of the brother and the alike. I think that if people look at the similarities between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, they'd be very surprised. There's a lot of overlapping kinds of tenets and the alike. But for some reason, we want to look at what's different between all of us and point fingers and the alike. I think, as the caller stated, I think it's critically important for us to remember that the actions of these two gentlemen, or suspects, I won't call them gentlemen, certainly do not reflect the basic tenets of Islam, and they do not reflect the majority of Islamic people in the United States.
Robert Taylor is director of the Executive Master of Science Program in Justice Administration and Leadership within the Department of Criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas, and he's co-author of the new book Terrorism, Intelligence, and Homeland Security. Bob, we really appreciate you making this time for us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Up next, we will speak with Aliyah Salem, Executive Director of the North Texas Chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. If you would like to join our conversation, you can do it by emailing think@kera.org. You can call 800-933-5372, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We've been talking about Sunday's terrorist shooting in Garland, where two gunmen, apparently offended by an anti-Muslim group's call for cartoon drawings of the Prophet Muhammad, approached the scene and opened fire, wounding a security guard before being shot and killed by police. Joining the conversation now is Aliyah Salem, Executive Director of the North Texas Chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, known for short as CARE. Aliyah, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
For people who don't have comparable rules in their own religions, can you explain why depictions of the Prophet Muhammad are so deeply offensive to Muslims?
Well, not only is this a man that 1.6 billion people love and revere and take much of their faith from, it's also an example that was set by the Prophet himself and by teachings that come from the religion. It's not explicitly stated in the Quran, but in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad himself, that we're not supposed to create a likeness of any of the prophets, including Prophet Muhammad. So Jesus and Moses and Adam, any of them, are not supposed to be depicted out of a sense of respect, and so that there's not a desire to start idolizing them in place of God.
Did you know about the event planned in Garland before the catastrophe happened on Sunday?
Yeah, we knew about it back in February.
And what was the discussion in the Muslim community about how to respond to this or how to not respond? What kinds of conversations did you hear?
So we had a couple of leaders meetings, actually, from some of our community leaders. And it was more of a sense of we need to be doing more proactive work. We do quite a bit of proactive work to outreach to the community, help them know who we are, things like that. But there was definitely a sense, and I know my personal sense was, we need to ignore this. This is what she does. She and her, those like her, make it, you know, part of their daily life. This is their job to go around the country doing this kind of stuff. So we're expectant of that, right? So there's no need to really respond to this kind of hatred with any, you know, we have a lot more important things to be worried about. So
in a city the size of Garland, in a metropolitan area the size of North Texas, 200 people at an event is disturbing, but it is not an overwhelming number of people. Can you give us some perspective on how you felt about the turnout at that event?
Well, seeing as how most of them, the vast majority of them, are not even from the Garland area, that lends a little bit of insight as to, you know, what this event is attracting. It's attracting people from outside of our community. So it doesn't alarm me as much as if it had been 200 to 300 people from Garland, 200 to 300 people from North Texas, because I don't perceive my community that way. We have, you know, great relations in our communities. I've lived my entire life. I'm 35 years old and born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas. So I have a very clear perception and protection of my community. So to see that coming from the outside, there are always going to be people who vehemently disagree with your lifestyle or your way of life and what you do, and they'll travel to do it. And clearly they made that journey. It doesn't worry me as much because I know that in my community, these individuals don't espouse to that level of hatred, that they, you know, they didn't show up. So I take a little bit of comfort. But I do think that as a community, we need to start looking at these types of things that we allow in as a community and start having discussions with regards to how we approach these types of issues.
I want to listen here to something. Anne-Marie Weiss-Armus, who is president of the DFW International Community Alliance, says that a show like the provocative Draw the Prophet exhibit might have no support if Muslims were better known to their North Texas neighbors.
If mayors hear from the local mosque, if Muslims are active volunteers in the community, showing that they are just like every other immigrant group, they're trusted, then we don't fear them.
You were mentioning a lot of proactive events.
Sure.
When you hear that statement, what do you want to respond?
Well, she's right to a degree. I mean, we can always do better. We can always work on those types of activities. Are we doing the right thing? Do we need to increase that kind of thing? But we are extremely active. We have Boy Scouts and we have Girl Scouts and we work with Habitat for Humanity. And one of our mosques, actually a few of our mosques, but one in particular in Irving, has an open house every single Sunday. Sometimes they take ads out in the newspaper to say, hey, come here, we're open, you know, come learn about us, so that you can demystify, like you said. And these types of activities, we do a lot of interfaith work. So I see that from, you know, firsthand. What is part of the problem is being able to translate that to the community so that people know that that's what we're doing right. So that's kind of some part of the uphill challenge that we have, is to try and help people see, well, this is what we're doing. We'd appreciate a little bit more exposure. Or, you know, why don't you come and partner with us and see what good things we're doing? So trying to get the word out about it is sometimes the uphill challenge. It's not necessarily doing the work. We've got a ton of coalition partners, interfaith partners, and the like that we do a lot of work for and that vouch for our community on a regular basis and stand in solidarity with us. So it's, the examples are there. We just need people to see that.
One thing I want to touch on in that statement that we just heard was Ms. Armus said, Weiss-Armus referred to immigrant groups. Mm-hmm. And clearly there is among some Americans a bias against Muslims. I wonder how much of that animosity you would ascribe to religious differences and how much of it you would ascribe to a sort of xenophobia and the assumption by many people that every Muslim in this country is an immigrant to this country, when in fact you were born here. The, the two men who appear to have committed the attack on Sunday were born in this country.
Well, the thing that you have to understand is when you have a country that is, we pride ourselves on our immigrants, right? This is a country built upon immigrants. And so we, what I think we need to do as a community, my personal take on this issue is that this has to do more, it connects more with the issues of structural racism than it does focusing on just the Muslim community. It's the same pattern of othering that people fall into when any new group comes into the spotlight. So I'm more of a fan of directing our attention towards the main issue, the issue of racism and othering and so on, and trying to work to dismantle that as opposed to trying to fight fires with regards to, oh, more Muslims are being treated badly. No, we're people of all minority groups are being treated badly in many ways. And so we, if we work to do that, but then also to focus on who Americans are, whether they're immigrants or like myself or indigenous to the United States, doesn't give us any, you know, better standing. You see what I'm saying? It's easy for us to say, oh, well, they're indigenous, so they, you know, should espouse the ideals. Clearly, in this case, that's not necessarily true. But many immigrants are college educated. The majority of our community, Muslim community, well educated with great jobs. There are teachers and engineers and lawyers and so on and so forth. As we have immigrants come into the community, I think one of the positive things that we could focus on are helping immigrants to acclimate to our society instead of trying to necessarily push, you know, somebody trying to push their culture upon the community they're coming into. There's always that you need to understand and we need to learn from one another. But we also, when we go into a country, if I were to go, you know, move somewhere else, if I was to go and move to Italy or something of another, you know, background that I'm accustomed to, I would learn the cultures and traditions and things like that to help acclimate and to be a part of the society completely, not to remove my identity. I'm always going to be an American. I'm always going to be a Texan. But at the same time, have that ability to work within my community from a group standpoint. So I think we can do some work there as well.
A lot of people, a lot of, you know, religious leaders with congregations of every faith around the country would say, I can't possibly conceive that anyone who I work with on a weekly basis could commit an act like this. And therefore, they wouldn't sort of get up and preach about not doing violent things. But many, many Americans believe that Muslim clerics should spend more time preaching against violence. And I wonder if you feel like this is something that is so not on the minds of many Muslim worshipers that it's just not something that comes up in services. Does the question make sense to you?
It does. And it is, to me, it's kind of, to me, that's actually a form of racism. The fact that we would be expected to talk about, you know, de-radicalizing our kids. We're, for the vast majority of us, we're not violent individuals. You're always going to have people who commit acts of violence. But if we do that, then we need to tell, you know, different churches in other parts of the country that they need to be focusing on it. Because we've got individuals from Christianity who are violent, who commit acts of terror in our own country. And whatever other demographic you want to put into play there, that's not what we're here to do. What we need to be focusing on is who we are as a community and building upon those good works and helping to engage and broaden in our communities from, you know, a complete standpoint, from a whole community, not from a religious silo, a more cultural silo. But, you know, together, it's going to take all of us to do this. So for us to be somehow singled out because of world events, the only reason, in my opinion, and this would stay to me, the only reason that I think that we focus a lot right now on Islam and Muslims is because that's what's in the media. That is what we are exposed to on a regular basis. Are we talking about the terrorism that's happening in Latin America? Are we talking about the terrorism that's happening in Africa? That has nothing to do with Islam. The Central African Republic, the Lord's Resistance Army. We're not talking about these huge terrorist groups that come from other faith backgrounds or no faith at all, because they don't make it to the media. We're focused on Islamic extremism in a post-9/11 world. Not to say that there's not Islamic extremism. There is. but we are focusing on the Muslim community as somehow having responsibility for that. And that, to me, is taking us away from what the real issues are. That, to me, is just finding somebody to push our frustrations onto and say, oh, it's their fault. They've got to deal with it. They've got to preach violence. I get asked on a regular basis, you need to denounce this. You need to denounce this. And I'm like, I did denounce it, just for the record. And they'll say, no, you need to denounce it every day. I'm like, go somewhere else with that, please, because I don't have time to sit there and denounce every single day of my life some random person from across the world or in other parts of the country that's doing something violent. I have nothing to do with that. I have no responsibility with that. Whether they claim in the name of a religion that I espouse, it's also not my problem. It's not my fault. What is my problem is my community. What is my problem are the things that are happening here, and which is why I'm involved in what's going on right now to try and work with our community to deal with these issues, but not what's happening in things that are outside of our control.
Given that in the minds of some in the broader American culture, there is an association made between, you know, two bad actors who did something in the mistaken belief that this was for the glory of God, and that there will be people who assume that this is somehow, you know, a representative act for all Muslim people. When something like this happens, when the news breaks from Garland, what goes through your head? Do you think, oh, here we go again? Or what? I mean, obviously you have concern for the victims, but I wonder sort of what, how you have to set in motion the kind of work that you do.
The most important thing is to collect yourself in the immediate aftermath of these types of things. It's, you know, you start going into panic mode and your brain starts racing. You know, in this particular situation, I was very emotional right after because I was worried about people and being harmed, basically. And then after that, it's kind of like your brain starts kicking into work mode and what you need to do. And it's more about securing the area. It's more about preparing your community. And in those immediate aftermaths, I didn't so much have a here we go again. I had, oh my God, what do we need to do first? Mm-hmm. How do we need to respond appropriately? What can we do to help? What can we do to help reduce tensions? How do we make our community safe for fear of backlash? Yesterday morning, I woke up to a very violent and very specific death threat that I received on my cell phone. I reported it, obviously. But no matter how many of those that I get, it doesn't leave you with any sense of, you know, it's okay, it's no big deal, you know, things like that. You don't get used to that. You don't get used to, you know, people threatening you and say, are you threatening me? And he says, no, I'm promising you. And you're like, oh, okay. So you kind of have to adjust and help your community adjust. Because when I'm in this on a daily basis, my job is to deal with hate. My job is to deal with discrimination. My job is to deal with crises. Most people, it's not. And so the hysteria that can come from the Muslim community or other individuals is very quick and very fast. It's very easy for people to get whipped up. So as a community leader, you also have to pay attention to how do I de-escalate the situation in my community, help people think clearly, not, you know, panic, not freak out. How can we deal with this, you know, kind of systematically and have an approach that respects what's the situation at hand and what are the facts of the issue, but then also recognize how did this happen in the first place, looking at all of the aspects of it and the things that incited it.
Aaliyah Salem is Executive Director of the Dallas-Fort Worth Chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Aaliyah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Earlier this hour, we heard from KERA News reporter Stella Chavez and terrorism scholar Robert Taylor of the University of Texas at Dallas. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.